From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
No, oh my God, no, please, God, let me not have herpes, please.
That's Amy Schumer in a sketch from her show Inside Amy Schumer. That sketch was written by our guest today, Schumer's head writer, Jesse Klein, who had her own herpes scare.
As I was waiting to find out what was going on, I just was like, please, God, don't let me have herpes.
Thankfully, it was a false alarm. Klein has a new collection of funny personal essays. One of the essays is about preparing for the birth of her child. She turned that experience into a comedy sketch, too.
All I know is I want a natural birth and definitely not an epidural.
Oh my God, of course not.
It's better for the baby.
So much better for the baby.
Klein's essay is called Get the Epidural. And Ken Tucker reviews the new album by Mitski called Puberty 2. That's coming up on Fresh Air. First news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Jesse Klein, is the head writer for Inside Amy Schumer, Comedy Central's Emmy Award-winning sketch comedy series. The show is written from a feminist perspective, and so is Klein's new collection of funny personal essays called You'll Grow Out of It, about her experiences dating, getting engaged, getting married, giving birth, and finding her place in the comedy world. Before she started writing for TV, she worked at Comedy Central, first as a temp and later in development, finding and working with new talent. She's also written for Saturday Night Live and Transparent and has done stand-up comedy. Jesse Klein, welcome to Fresh Air. Let's start with a reading from your new book. You want to start from the very beginning?
Sure. This is the chapter called Tom Man. Everyone is charmed by a little tomboy, a scrappy little girl in overalls with a ponytail and scraped knees who loves soccer and baseball and comic books and dirt. But what are we charmed by? It's not just that she's cute. It's that she so innocently thinks she's going to stay this way forever. But we all know she won't. And why is that? Because as much as we like a tomboy, nobody likes a tom man. You might be wondering, what is a tom man? I've never heard this term before. You're correct. That is because I invented it. It is the only thing I have ever invented. A tom man is what happens when a tomboy just never grows out of it. For as far back as I can remember, the voice in my head has sounded like the voice of a man. You might think the next thing I'm going to tell you has something to do with being gay or thinking I'm a man trapped in a woman's body, but neither is the case. What I mean is that literally, walking around as a child, the little voice I'd hear narrating my own thoughts and experiences sounded like Daniel Stern in The Wonder Years. I think this is because the very idea of possessing an inner voice felt by definition like a male characteristic. In contrast, the tent poles of femininity, as I observed them, high heels, eye makeup, Diet Coke, smiling, etc., all seemed to be focused on the external. In any case, they felt completely foreign to me. As a result, throughout my childhood, I felt like an outsider to being a straight girl, even though I was a straight girl.
That's Jesse Klein reading from her new book, You'll Grow Out of It. So what were some of the things that girls of your generation were doing that you didn't relate to?
Oh, my gosh. I would say it started even just with Barbies. I never had any interest in Barbies at all. It just didn't seem like a fun doll. And then just going on the occasions that I went to any sleepovers, which I didn't do very often because I didn't have many friends. Just makeup, no interest. Skirts, no interest. Dresses, no interest. Diet Coke, no interest at the time. I would say just kind of the whole thing. I didn't relate to it, and I just didn't feel organically interested in any of it.
I love that you really wanted to have men find you very sexy, but you didn't want to wear the things that were supposed to be sexy, including sexy underwear, which you write about a lot. And you've come up, I must say, with the great phrase, the thong industrial complex. Thank you for that.
Thank you. And you're welcome.
So are there aspects of the whole sexy thing that struck you not only as wrong for you, but as absurd?
Yes. Again, kind of all of it. I was born in 1975, and I don't know when thongs were invented. I suppose I could have Wikipedia'd that before I got here. but it seems, you know, it's like they're along the way between then and now. It seems like a whole bunch of problems got invented. I don't feel like I remember women worrying as much about a panty line as they do now, like that should be such an eyesore, is to notice someone's underwear slightly underneath their clothes. Thongs are really like a big thorn for me. But I think also even like it wasn't kind of a law that you had to have a perfect manicure and pedicure all the time. It feels like that's something that kind of, I think my mother to this day has had maybe one manicure, and it's one that I forced her to have because I thought, oh, maybe this is an enjoyable experience for us to share. And she was like, what is this? Why are we doing this? I think so much of it is really absurd.
But so you had this real crisis when you were getting married and you had to buy a bridal dress.
Oh.
And you never really liked that whole princess fantasy dress thing, but the whole bridal gown industry is kind of based on that.
Yeah.
And you nearly had a meltdown while you were shopping for your dress because you couldn't find something that fit you, that you also liked, that you felt comfortable in, and that you could afford. But, like, just in terms of the argument you were having or the conversation you were having with yourself about how you should deal with a wedding dress, can you go over some of that conversation for us?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I definitely started when we got engaged and were planning. I mean, at first we did City Hall, and then we thought, oh, well, it's something for your family, and let's have a real wedding, small wedding. And I'm like, right, well, I'm a cool feminist who doesn't really care about this stuff. I probably won't even wear a wedding dress at all. I was just very like, oh, I'm too cool for this. And I'll wear jean shorts or a tube top. I don't care. And then I had some friends who were interested in taking me shopping. Like, that's a thing too, I guess. But I think once I put one toe in the water of like deciding I would wear a dress and that I would try one on, I got like hooked into the conflict of it. And it was sort of like a double wound. I think there's like this idea in Buddhism of like there's the thing that's hurting you, and then something, it's hurting you that it's hurting you, if that makes any sense. I could feel that I wanted to find a dress that I looked really pretty in. I could feel, you know, being someone who lives in a society where that is like a pressure that on your wedding day you're going to look perfect. I suddenly was like, oh, I'm susceptible. I actually do feel this. And then I was just so angry that I felt it. And that kind of led to a very schizophrenic series of conversations in sweaty dressing rooms by myself.
And you finally rejected the super expensive dress that you almost bought and bought something much cheaper, which you ended up taking off before the wedding party was over.
Yeah.
Put on a simple shift instead.
Yeah, I ended up putting on, I had bought like something at J. Crew that I would end the evening in. Yeah, I bought a dress. I don't know what expense, it's relative. But yeah, I had a flirtation with buying a $10,000 dress. Even saying it, I feel so embarrassed. It was, I was at the end of the search, which had taken months. I was running out of time, and I saw this little Valentino, like Audrey Hepburn-y dress, and I put it on, and I have to say it was beautiful and it looked amazing, and I hadn't looked at the price tag, and I was like, oh my god, I found it. And then I looked down and it was $10,000, which is very much out of the budget. And I had what I would describe to friends as like, oh, this is like what men think about when they're like pondering murdering their wives. It's just like this bargaining of how it's going to go. I was just like, well, I won't tell anyone what it costs, and I'll buy it in cash, and there'll be no credit card trail, and I'll throw away the tags, and I'll say that it was from, TJ Maxx or something. And I just had a real plan. And then I kind of looked in the mirror and I was like, oh God, what have I become? And I kind of ran out of there. It was absolutely not about the dress. It was my own crisis of identity. And I think this feeling of this is me needing to look like a pretty lady woman for literally, what is it ultimately, 3 hours? And can I not even get this done for 3 hours? And at that point, it started to feel less like this choice that I've sometimes participated in of I don't want to be a girl that looks like that girl. And it became, oh, I'm really not even capable. Like, I just can't get it done at all. And I think that's what got me so agitated.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jessie Klein. She's a comic. She's the head writer of Inside Amy Schumer, and now she has her first book, a collection of funny personal essays called You'll Grow Out of It. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll be right back and talk more. This is Fresh Air.
Hi,
This is Fresh Air, and if you're just joining us, my guest is Jessie Klein. She's a comic, and she's the head writer of Inside Amy Schumer, and now she has her first book, a collection of funny personal essays called You'll Grow Out of It. So part of the book was written when you were single, part of the book was written when you were engaged and then married, and by the time the book is over, you have a child. So I want to cover
some of all
those
Terry.
Bases. Yes. So during the point before you were married, when you were dating, and you write about that period of your life, there's a guy you'd started dating who you thought was a really great guy, even though there were signs that maybe he wasn't. And at a point when you incorrectly thought that you were both getting serious about each other, he asked you if it was okay if he didn't use a condom. And you write that having you write that having grown up in the height of the AIDS epidemic, you were always very, very cautious about that. You knew all about STDs, but you agreed to do it. You agreed to let him not use
wow.
it.
And wow. This went to a dark place real quick.
Well, I
think that's fine. No, I write about it, so let's get into it.
You write about it, and I think it's a really interesting thing that I think probably every woman has had to deal with at some point. So
I do believe that's true.
Yeah. So, like, looking back on it, why did you say yes?
Actually, the answer itself is probably quite almost tragically PG, if not G. It's so crazy when you see yourself as a relatively intelligent person and in fact, I've always kind of put that aspect of my identity kind of forward to myself. I'm like, well, I wasn't always like the cutest girl or, you know, I wasn't good at sports, but like I'm smart and I'm funny and that's my thing. And I wear glasses and I have a ponytail. I'm not going to be the girl that sleeps with a guy without a condom. That's for other people. But it is one of those things where you hear women talk about all kinds of experiences that they get into, not to compare one to the other, but when you hear women talk about having gotten into abusive relationships, and this was certainly not an abusive relationship, but people end up doing things that they just don't know how they got there, and they're shocked that they're there. And that was kind of, this whole experience was, I think I just, even though I wasn't really that young at the point that this happened, I was in my very early 30s. But that whole chapter was about, I hadn't dated this kind of a guy before, or I hadn't been in this kind of dynamic before. And he was very charismatic, and I do believe probably ultimately a good guy. And I guess I felt like when he asked me, because he asked in the moment, kind of like, do we need to wear a condom? You know, or whatever the words were, basically saying, can I not wear one? And he just had seemed so charming that I was like, well, clearly he would only ask me that. It's embarrassing to say these words. Clearly he would only ask me that if he feels like he's falling in love with me and sort of knows that neither of us are ever going to sleep with a different person ever again, which is probably the opposite of why a guy asks you if you can skip a condom. I had this sort of optimistic blinders on, I guess.
One of the really awkward things about a question like that from a guy is it puts you in the role of being the bad guy. Like, you're the one who's saying no. You're the one who, you know, is doing something.
Yeah, I'm
that's
the one
just
flicking
like,
the lights on at the end of the party.
Yeah. Yeah. And then there was a herpes scare right after that.
Yep. Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
But it was just a scare. It turned out to not be herpes.
Let's underline that portion. Yeah.
Which is very, very good.
I don't have herpes.
Now, there was a really hilarious herpes sketch on the Amy Schumer show that I think you wrote.
I did.
And I want to play that sketch and that talk about how, like, your life experience fit into this sketch.
Okay.
So in the sketch, Amy Schumer is on the phone and she finds out that the guy she just slept with has herpes, and she's in this total panic that she's going to have it too. So she starts negotiating with God, you know, like, she can't get herpes, like, please don't give me herpes. And then to her amazement, God appears, and God is played by Paul Giamatti, who is dressed in all white for the role. So,
basically playing himself.
So this scene starts with Amy Schumer in a state of hysteria.
No, oh my God, no, please, God, let me not have herpes, please.
Well, look who it is.
God?
Do you remember when the last time I heard from you was?
It was probably pretty recently when my friend Tig got cancer. Pretty sure I reached out then.
No, it was 7 years ago when you were rooting for the Green Knights at Medieval Times.
Oh, well, God, thank you so much for coming through for me that night.
You're welcome. This guy, Bobby Skeltis, that you slept with? God. What are you doing?
I know, I can do so much better, you're right.
I didn't say that. You know, 70% of people who reach out to me are having a herpes scare. Mm-hmm. Why should I help you?
Okay. That's a fair question.
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm kind of like a public figure now.
Mm.
Like a role model. So if some young girl saw me buying Valtrex or something, it would be like a thing.
Right. A thing. Mm. Like that earthquake in Peru yesterday that killed 9,000 people.
Oh, my God, I hope no one was hurt.
Oh, gosh. I really need to stop making so many white girls. Let me be honest with you, okay? You did get herpes. You already have it.
No!
Yes! Now, for me to undo your herpes, I have to create balance in the universe. You understand?
Totally.
I'd have to kill off an entire village in Uzbekistan.
Yeah, whatever you think is best, do it.
You'll also have to sacrifice something.
Oh my God, name it.
Okay, you need to stop drinking.
Pass.
How about stop using hairspray? The aerosol is very bad for the environment. How about you just call your mother a little bit more often? That's an easy one.
What is herpes exactly? It's an outbreak like once a year?
Yeah.
I don't know. I think I'll just take it.
Okay, fine. Herpes it is.
So that's a sketch from Inside Amy Schumer with Amy Schumer and Paul Giamatti. My guest, Jesse Klein, is the head writer on the show, and she wrote that sketch. I thought it was interesting that you cast Amy Schumer in the role of like really spoiled suburban girl who's willing to like sacrifice villages in return for her not getting herpes. And God, Paul Giamatti says he has to stop making so many white girls.
Yeah.
So why did you do the sketch from the point of view of somebody who's being like very selfish in her willingness to sacrifice other people so that she wouldn't have herpes? Because it's a very legitimate prayer to not have any disease or any disorder.
Yes. I think herpes is sort of in that perfect place on the line of yes, it is a real disease, but it is also extremely manageable and livable, and on the spectrum of maladies that one might have, it is certainly not the worst. And I think by just kind of playing up that type of very narcissistic, very self-centered person as the person who's talking to Paul Giamatti as God, it kind of heightened, I think, how everyone feels about it in that moment. And so even if you're not a suburban girl monster, I think in the moment that you are really afraid that that's going to happen to you, you feel the intensity that way. Although ultimately, again, it's really not such a big deal, I guess.
So how did you know Amy Schumer, and how did that lead to you writing for Inside Amy Schumer?
Amy and I met doing stand-up. I had been doing stand-up for a while, and one night we're at this show that I believe the first time we met, it was at a show that was run out of like a children's aid society, if that's still a thing, like a gym. And I watched her from the back of the room, and I'd never seen her before. She was definitely not famous. And I was just like, oh, this girl's so funny. And she specifically talked about, I remember she confessed that she had HPV, in this very casual, thrown aside way. And it just like blew me away. And because I also have HPV, like many others. That's the one I do have. And I was like, I love that she just said that. And then we talked afterwards. I just adored her. And when she got her Comedy Central pilot, we had seen it. We would see each other around. And she texted me and was like, do you want to work on this pilot? And we went and had some drinks and got drunk. And that's what happened.
My guest is Jesse Klein, the head writer for the Comedy Central sketch comedy series Inside Amy Schumer. Klein has written a new collection of funny personal essays called You'll Grow Out of It. After a short break, we'll talk about another experience she turned into a comedy sketch. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the law firm Cooley LLP. With offices in the U.S., Europe, and China, Cooley advises entrepreneurs, investors, financial institutions, and established companies around the world, where innovation meets the law. And from Cancer Treatment Centers of America, where nutritional therapy is part of every patient's treatment plan to help boost their immune system and manage side effects during treatment. More about integrative cancer care is available at cancercenter.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Jesse Klein, the head writer for Inside Amy Schumer, the Comedy Central sketch comedy series. She's written a new collection of funny personal essays called You'll Grow Out of It, about her experiences dating, getting engaged, getting married, giving birth, and finding her place in the comedy world. Klein is also a stand-up comic and has written for several other TV shows. So I find it really interesting to have watched Inside Amy Schumer and then read your book, and see some of the same issues dealt with in different ways. Like in your book, it's all like totally about you, totally personal. And on the show, even the things that are from your own experience are, you know, transformed into a comedy sketch. So Another example, in your book, you write about deciding to have a child after you got married and then, you know, finally getting pregnant. And you have a whole chapter that's called, in capital letters, Get the Epidural.
And, please.
And, you know, it's all about how you didn't want to deal with the pain of it. You also wrote a sketch for Inside Amy Schumer called Better for the Baby, in which a small group of women are sitting around. They're all, like, very pregnant. They're all, you know, almost ready to go into labor.
Yeah,
and they're comparing
ripe.
Notes about the totally perfect, natural, lovely childbirth that they're going to have. And it almost becomes a game of, like, one-upsmanship.
Mm-hmm.
So let's hear that sketch. And you wrote this, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So let's hear that sketch written by my guest, Jesse Klein. And Amy Schumer speaks first.
You guys?
Yeah.
I am so glad that we all got pregnant at the exact same time.
Yeah.
Isn't that a treat?
Oh, have you guys figured out your birth plans?
Oh, yeah. For
all
months.
I know is I want a natural birth and definitely not an epidural.
Oh, my God.
I
mean, of course not.
It's better for the baby.
It is better for the baby.
So much better for the baby.
Yeah.
We are having a water birth, but instead of water, we're going to fill the tub with gender-neutral barley, which is also the name of the baby it will be better for.
Oh, my little
barley. You see, love how that goes together.
My midwife suggested a sea turtle birth.
What is that?
Oh, it's when you give birth on a beach and you dig a small hole and you kick sand on the baby and you see if it crawls into the ocean or into your arms.
Wow.
It's better for the baby.
You know what? I would be careful, though, with a midwife. Even though they're not technically doctors, they still have some medical training.
And close enough.
I just don't trust Western medicine at this point. That's why I'm having my baby on the highest mountaintop in Tibet, as far from real medical help as is humanly possible.
Oh,
so smart.
My doula's a Sherpa.
Oh.
My doula is a 3-month-old baby, so she, like, gets it.
Wow.
So beautiful.
Sounds authentic.
Well, I hope you all plan on eating the placenta.
Of course.
Yum, 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 yum. Every
except
drop.
Except for the part that you bury in the front yard. Mm-hmm. It's so full of nutrients.
I'm just juicing it. It's better for the mother. Oh, no. And the baby.
Mm.
Oh, my God, you guys. I don't care about myself.
God. Oh, my God.
That's an excerpt of the sketch, Better for the Baby, written by my guest, Jesse Klein, who's the head writer of Inside Amy Schumer and now has a collection of personal essays, funny essays, called You'll Grow Out of It. So tell us how your experience transformed into that sketch.
It felt so foreign and crazy to me to be pregnant in the first place. I hadn't really anticipated that I would have a baby necessarily. It just always felt so surreal. But I did, in my contact with other pregnant women or women who had had kids, there did feel sometimes like this game of one-upmanship that would be happening around just how holistic and perfect a birth anyone could have. And there's this contest that, as I write in the book, a friend of mine at one point really helped me out because she said, What are you trying to win? And there really is nothing to win. And I hope more women who are pregnant or women who are not pregnant, because I think this also goes into other aspects of women's lives too. I think we often feel like we're in a contest of some kind, and the contest is generally kind of a bummer, and the prize is usually also an illusion and is false.
Well, related to childbirth, you have a story in your book about you finally get an Emmy for Inside Amy Schumer. Very exciting. You'd only recently given birth. And as everybody's going to the after parties to celebrate, you're in a room alone pumping.
Yeah.
Because you still have breast milk.
Yep.
And describe how
try
you,
not to be jealous.
Describe how you emotionally felt in that moment. I mean, on the one hand, like, you're so lucky, like, you have a husband you love, you'd given birth, the birth went well, you had a healthy baby, you were pumping, you just won an Emmy. Like, it doesn't get better than that. But how are you actually feeling?
I don't want to underplay how genuinely awesome and exciting it was to win an Emmy. And that was an incredible moment and was just thrilling. But yeah, then I did have to retreat as the show was ending. The producers had very nicely arranged for me to have a little dressing room that someone else had used and was done with. And I had my pump, and my friends and coworkers, you know, went on to the governor's ball, which is the big after party. And I said I would catch up with them when I was done pumping. And I'm sitting there with the Emmy statue at my feet, and I have to, you know, I'm wearing kind of a fancy dress, and I have to figure out how to unzip it on my own. And then I put on my nursing bra, and my boobs are out, and the pump makes this really kind of ridiculous, unpleasant, like, zhoot, zhoot, zhoot noise that's very loud. And technically, when you have these really ugly hands-free pumping bras on, they'll show you ads of women, like, you know, practically doing aerobics while they're pumping, but that was not my experience. I generally wanted to sit in one place, so I'm kind of just forced to sit doing nothing. And as I'm sitting there, I felt a little lonely, and I was kind of feeling like I wanted to be at the party, and I'd also felt like, oh, I'm now that I'm not on stage, like I'm not famous, and I, you know, I had a lot going on in my own life at that point with exhaustion, and my baby was only 3 months old, and you know, having a baby is really hard on a marriage. So things with my husband were just, I'll just say they were very hard, because we were just so tired, and it's so crazy, and I just suddenly felt very much like, oh, I won this Emmy, and tomorrow I'm getting on a plane and I'm going right back into my own little struggles, and nothing is really different. Like, this was great, but now it is over, and I just have to be back in my sort of currently overweight, milk-laden body, and waking up at 2 a.m. and 4 a.m, and it's hard. And the Emmy is amazing, but all of this will continue. I think it just brought into very stark relief in the moment what would have been the truth no matter what I was doing, but it was very immediate, which is that this doesn't really mean anything for your actual happiness or your life.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jessie Klein. She's a comic. She's the head writer for Inside Amy Schumer, and now she has a new collection of personal essays, funny ones called You'll Grow Out of It. We're going to take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Squarespace, providing tools to help people showcase their passions with a customizable landing page, website, or online store. Squarespace also offers domains, hosting, and 24/7 support at squarespace.com/NPR. And from Progressive Insurance, with insurance for cars, home, boat, motorcycles, RVs, and commercial vehicles at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com.
This is Fresh Air, and if you're just joining us, my guest is Jessie Klein. She's a writer, she's a comic, she's the head writer of Inside Amy Schumer, and now she has her first book, a collection of funny personal essays called You'll Grow Out of It. One of the things you write about is age, and along those lines you write about how you hate being called ma'am, because it implies like you're no longer a miss, you've reached a certain age, and whereas men are just always sir, there's this like delineation between miss and ma'am, and so you're just automatically getting judged by your age.
Yeah.
Which leads me to another sketch I want to play and to talk about how that connects to either your life or life as you see it. This is one of the most, perhaps the most famous sketch from Inside Amy Schumer, and I can't say the title on the air because it has the F word in it. But it's about the last day in a woman's life, particularly in an actress's life, when she's seen as sexually attractive to men. And we all know for actresses that there seems to be a very short shelf life, and you get like the leading lady roles and you're sexy and everything, and you reach a certain age, maybe 40 tops, when you're not
tops.
That anymore.
Big time tops.
Yeah. Whereas like men get to be leading men for like really long periods of time.
Yeah.
Okay.
Through being dead. Yeah.
Okay. So this is a sketch in which Amy is taking a walk through this beautiful pastoral area, and she stumbles upon three actresses, Julia Louis-Dreyfus, Tina Fey, and Patricia Arquette, all seated around a picnic table, having a lovely dinner. And they're celebrating that it's Julia Louis-Dreyfus's last day when Hollywood is going to see her as sexually appealing, because she's just gotten old enough where she's crossed the line. And Amy Schumer doesn't quite understand, so she asks for them to explain.
I mean, how do you know? Who tells you?
Well, nobody really overtly tells you, but there are signs. How Sally Field was Tom Hanks's love interest in Punchline, and then like 20 minutes later she was his mom in Forrest Gump.
Or you might get offered a rom-com with Jack Nicholson where you're competing with another woman. Or I just had an audition for Mrs. Claus.
You're kidding me.
I read for that part.
I read for that too.
You did?
Hey, who got that?
J-Lo.
Oh, she'll be good.
She's going to be really good.
Really good. Mm. Or you go to a movie set, you go to wardrobe, mm-hmm. and the only thing they have for you to wear are long sweaters, like cover you up head to toe kind of thing.
Where like the poster for your movie is just like a picture of a kitchen.
Yeah. With these very uplifting and yet vague titles like Whatever It Takes or She Means Well, that kind of thing, right?
Mm-hmm. Another common sign is when they start remaking your best movies with younger actresses. I guess they're remaking Boyhood with Selena Gomez at my part. Mm.
That's going to make a lot of money.
So that's a very famous sketch from Inside Amy Schumer, written by my guest, Jesse Klein, the head writer for the show. So how did you come up with this idea of the last day when Hollywood is going to find you sexually appealing?
Your last very, very special day.
Yes.
your most special of days, having your most special quality. That was an idea that definitely came out of conversation in the room, and we'd been looking, I guess there was an Us Weekly floating around the room, and we were looking at pictures of actresses and, you know, the Who Wore It Best and Everyone Looks Amazing. And then, you know, we just started talking about, like, at what point people start to age out of being in those magazines and kind of start to end up on the covers of the really kind of lowbrow ones with pictures of them at the beach and, oh, look who's aging terribly, when that same person 2 years ago was like so hotsy-totsy in the middle of the magazine. And I guess we just kind of started talking about what would happen if you took that idea all the way to its conclusion, which was, you know, it was funny to me to think about, well, what if there's this kind of Malcolm Gladwell-y tipping point that's really specific? You know, we kind of age slowly, but how does it work in magazines, and how does it work in Hollywood? Like, at what little visual change is suddenly too gross to see on a magazine or in a movie or on TV? And so that's kind of how that idea got taken to that place.
My guest is Jesse Klein. She's a writer. She's a comic. She's the head writer of Inside Amy Schumer. And now she has her first book, a collection of funny personal essays called You'll Grow Out of It. How did you figure out who you were going to be on stage and what your stories were going to be about? And I'll say, a lot of what you talk about, in what I've seen anyways, has to do with being a woman, with being sexual, with dealing with some of the things that arise from that. How did you find your voice?
I guess I found my voice the way most people as stand-ups find their voice, which is just getting on stage and working it out over and over and over again. But for me, I started to feel like I felt like I was hitting a note that was comfortable for me and comfortable for the audience when I sort of talked about, you know, my struggles with trying to fit into this sort of sexually acceptable girl type and just how impossible that was. That felt like what was really true and for me. And I think when you're on stage, when you find the things you can talk about that are really honest, that's usually when the audience responds. And that was certainly the case for me.
Did you have to overcome a certain sense of discretion that you were brought up with in order to do that kind of comedy?
Yeah, I did. And that's something I think I still struggle with. I have very amazing parents that I'm very close with, but it was not a repressive household in any kind of sense. It's, you know, not like a religious thing or anything like that. But it's certainly not one of those houses where I'm joking around with my parents about my sex life or vice versa. They actually haven't read the book yet. They're going to get it today. So we'll just see how those conversations evolve.
So you had to take a big risk in your life to actually become a performer, to become a comic and to become a full-time comedy writer as opposed to working on comedy development of other people, like developing other people's talent for Comedy Central.
Right.
You got an offer, and you write about this in your book, you got an offer from the David Letterman show to have a 13-week contract to be a writer for Late Night.
Yeah.
And the understanding was if you did good in those 13 weeks, they'd renew it for another 13 weeks and take it from there. This is a huge thing. I mean, writing for Letterman, that's huge.
Yeah.
So when you got the offer, your father was very skeptical that this was a good deal since it was only like a 13-week contract with the possibility of another 13-week contract. And you decided to decline the offer. Did you regret that after you declined? That like maybe you sold out like your big opportunity?
Yeah, I definitely did. You know, it was my dad's skepticism. And I'll just also say, I mean, the 13-week offer is a standard contract in a lot of TV writing. That's kind of what the length of their terms are that get renewed. And, you know, my father came from difficult circumstances. And I think he himself, his risk averseness was really out of love and a sense of wanting to protect me from harsh circumstances. But I think like a lot of people, I was just really scared of betting on myself. And I think there was also that idea that I had growing up in a kind of middle class household of letting go of a very steady paycheck. You know, I'd had this job that was, you know, I had a salary and I was kind of guaranteed 52 weeks of paychecks. And I had to learn to kind of really, it's like let go of that vine. And I did regret it. I had like a panic attack after I turned that job down and thought, what have I done? But in some ways, I think I needed to feel, I think I needed to have that low point to really mentally accept that I wanted to write and perform. I don't think I could have done it before that happened.
Well, Jesse Klein, thank you so much for talking with us. I think you're really funny, and I wish you good luck on all the things that you do.
Oh, thank you so much. It was so fun to be on. Thank you.
Jesse Klein is the head writer for Inside Amy Schumer. Her new book is called You'll Grow Out of It. After we take a short break, rock critic Ken Tucker will review the new album by Mitski called Puberty 2. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Our rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of the new album by Mitski. That's the stage name of a singer-songwriter in her 20s who has described herself as half Japanese, half American, but not fully either. Her new fourth album is called Puberty 2. That's the number 2.
The voice Mitski most often uses is a haunted one, a low, commanding tone that can break loose into a passionate cry when the emotions she's tapping into demand it. She and her producer Patrick Hyland play all the music on the album, and they like to keep their keyboards, guitars, and the minimal percussion tucked behind Mitski's voice. You can hear the way she builds a song on Your Best American Girl, which begins quietly. About halfway through that song, the stakes are raised. The guy she's singing to needs to know who he's dealing with. She describes herself as someone his mother wouldn't approve of. This Japanese-American woman calls her guy an all-American boy, for whom she's going to try to be, quote, your all-American girl. I think I'll regret this, she adds. Now listen to how much more fierce this song, Your Best American Girl, becomes at its climax. On the beautifully tense and controlled song, Fireworks, Mitski talks about recovering from what she calls a sadness, which she likens to pulling out a knife that's sticking in her side. The music that surrounds this language is minimal, a couple of guitar chords and keyboard fills, while her voice, in a kind of echo chamber, floods the song with the immensity of that sadness. The name of the album is Puberty 2, that number 2 attached as though it was a movie sequel. But in this case, Mitski creates music that serves as a heightened remembrance of adolescence. She's tapping into memories that aren't all that musty for someone in her mid-20s, yet which are being shaped by a singer who is very much an adult woman. Once More to See You begins with a big 1960s girl group beat, to speak of a romance that's being conducted in secret. And the secret itself becomes a powerful element, a partner, a co-conspirator in the relationship. This album has an impressively wide range of sounds, with big highs and low lows. Her music gets classified as indie rock, but until I read that label applied to it in a number of places, that category hadn't occurred to me. Because Mitski's music seems so much larger, so much more all-inclusive than a specific genre. It's music that presents itself as a series of private thoughts, but which its author knows speaks to ideas and feelings her audience is having all the time.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Yahoo TV. He reviewed Mitski's new album, Puberty 2. Tomorrow on Fresh Air, reflections on being married to a Navy fighter pilot. We talk with Rachel Sarnes. Her new memoir, The War at Home, is about the impact of her husband's long and frequent absences on the marriage and the difficulty she's had maintaining her own identity when his military career has defined so much of their lives. I hope you'll join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Henry Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, and Thea Chaloner. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Whole Foods Market, where yellow signs identify featured items throughout stores each week, from grass-fed burgers to gluten-free buns. Whole Foods Market, committed to quality standards and planet-friendly practices. And from the Pew Charitable Trusts, working with states to develop data-driven, nonpartisan solutions for complex issues. Learn more at pewtrusts.org.